This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. My name is Patsy Gill, coming to you from WTAN 1340, Tampa Bay's Tantalk Radio, in beautiful Clearwater, Florida. I was waiting for a special guest, Jojo Moyes, a best-selling author, but we've had some technical difficulties. She is on tour today for it's a release of her new book, After You. She is a best-selling author. She was on the best-selling list for 65 weeks. And I'm hoping that if I can't get her on today, we will get her on another time. Meanwhile, while I'm waiting, I want to talk to you a little bit about the upcoming Festival of Reading in Tampa Bay. It's going to be an exciting event, October 24th, sponsored by Tampa Bay Times and Judy Blum, the author of Fudge and so many other wonderful books, is going to be the main speaker and one of the main people there to see and to meet. And I'm sure that everyone will enjoy spending some time with her and listening to her about talking about how she has over the years, from the beginning where she started off with her children's book, the famous Fudge series, and how she's developed over the years as a writer and some of her most recent books. The festival this is the 23rd year, and it's very exciting to have so many wonderful authors coming to the Tampa Bay area. One of the other writers that will be there is Ace Atkins. He's a New York Times best-selling author. He's written 17 novels, and it would be a wonderful opportunity to meet to all of these authors. Amber Tamberlin, who is a best-selling author and has written a book called Dark Sparkler, which is very exciting, will also be there. So do think about attending this event. It's free of charge, and it's open to everyone to come and to meet the authors, to hear their stories, the background of their books, and to get selfies. I hope that I'm just waiting to have for a word is looking at my producer there. I don't know if we have her on. Do we have her? Yay!
Hi.
Okay. A little confusion there, Jojo. It's so nice to talk to you. So this is Jojo Moyes. I was just telling everyone about you. What can I say? You are amazing. There are not many people who have been 65 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
That was pretty amazing, I have to say.
It's like a
dream come true.
Oh,
it was kind of incredible.
It is incredible. And then at a certain point, you had three of your books on the best-selling list.
Yeah, you better stop because I think people are just going to not like me anymore.
No. Well, it's a well-deserved success. I know that you sold at least 5 million of the your book, the one before this, it's called Me Before You, which is a nice title. And you sold 5 million of those. So the new book that's coming out today, so this is an exciting day for you, is called After You. So tell us a little bit about it.
So really, the book picks up 18 months after the end of Me Before You. And it was a book I hadn't planned to write, but something kind of strange happened with Me Before You, which is, unlike the books I wrote before that one, I just had this endless stream of emails and messages from people who wanted to talk about Louisa Clark, the main character. And I don't know if it was because they saw themselves in her or because it reflected something that was going on in their own lives, but it meant that whereas mostly your characters leave you once you've finished a book, Louisa never did. And so finally, after kind of a couple of years of responding to these reader emails, I allowed myself to ask the question that they were asking me, which was, well, what would happen to her next? And once I had an answer, I just felt I had to write the book.
Well, you know, if there had been tweets in the old days, Margaret Mitchell might have done a sequel to Gone with the Wind. But in your case,
what a thought that is.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
In your case, you know, it's always hard to do a sequel. It's not a easy thing because you have to maintain the integrity of your characters, and you have done that.
That's exactly it.
With the new book.
I hope you think so.
Yes.
I thought it was going to be easy. I'm going to admit that. I thought that because I knew the character so well and I had this plot mapped out in my head, I thought, well, this is going to be great because my biggest problem is usually creating the characters. That's the thing that I really put the most work into, just to try and make people who are kind of complex and a bit original and interesting. And what happened was I started writing and then I just kept hearing the voices of readers and feeling this weight of expectation of people sort of saying, oh, no, she wouldn't do that, or I don't like the fact that she did this. And it was quite paralyzing for a while. And in the end, I sat down with a friend of mine who's also a novelist, and she was pretty tough with me, and she just said, you cannot think about what other people think. You just have to write the book that you want to write and, you know, hope that they'll come along with you. But you can't think about what other people are going to think. And she was absolutely right, because as soon as I just went back to being in my bubble, as she put it, then it came a lot more easily.
Well, it's always exciting when you write characters, and of course, for any writer, really good writer like you, our characters become so much a part of us that it is hard to put them away, and so it's rather fun that you got to do this.
Oh, do you know, it was the most fun because there's not a lot of characters who I really feel a kind of huge personal connection to. But I loved writing Louisa. I still love writing her. She was one of those rare things, you know, the character that just kind of drops fully formed into your lap. And I knew who she was from the start. And it means that I can kind of put her in all sorts of situations and know how she will react. And I'm sure you and a lot of your writer listeners will know that that really doesn't always happen. So yeah, I love writing her. I never get tired of it.
Well, one thing I love about your books is that I love how you managed, well, you sort of juxtapose the upper class and lower class as it's thought about in England. Now in America, of course, we don't have that class thing. So, you know, but I lived in England for quite a few years. I lived in Sonning, you know, near Henley.
Uh-huh.
And so I was aware of the class difference and how, you know, in Lou's case, you know, she's a barmaid, and yet, you know, there's all this other class mixture that you do, and I think I love it. That's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. I mean, as a writer, it's you know, the thing that books really thrive on is tension, and what class does is introduce a whole nother layer of tension into people's relationships. And I think it's only when you leave the UK that you realized how locked into that structure we all are, especially outside London, funny enough. You know, it's kind of made explicit in the countryside by the kinds of houses that people live in.
It's people don't understand. I explain. I would know people who had made a fortune and they bought beautiful, you know, Georgian homes, and they did everything with the greatest taste, and they, you know, renovated them and, you know, but it didn't matter because always where they were born or what class they were born into was always the defining factor. Unlike in America,
that's
where
so
you can,
true.
You know, you can be dirt poor and become a millionaire and you can talk about being dirt poor and you're proud of being dirt poor. Whereas in England, it doesn't quite work that way. It's a matter of a combination of the accent, which you never, you know,
mm-hmm.
And it's fun. I like that that you take just ordinary, you know, a barmaid or a cleaning woman and make mm-hmm. them the main, you know, figure in the story, because most people aren't upper class, and you know, so it's I think it works very well for you.
Oh, thank you. I agree. I think that possibly, you know, what we would call the working classes get a bit of a raw deal in fiction, because in the UK, if people are including kind of those sorts of jobs and those sorts of scenarios, it usually means that someone's about to get murdered. People don't tend to be massively interested in the lives of people at the bottom. And I am interested because I've kind of done those jobs in the past, and I'm interested in kind of society as a whole and what happens if you are brought up in the belief that, you know, you can be anything and do anything, but in a society which is increasingly kind of structured so that you probably can't. And, you know, I like to sort of look at the way people keep themselves in those prisons as well. I mean, the thing that sort of interested me about Lou in this book was how we can think we learn these life lessons and you want to move on and lead a bigger life and take forward all the things that you've learned, but often we just slide back into old patterns of behavior, and it's really luck and judgment whether you manage to pull yourself back out again.
Well, I think one of the hallmarks of your writing is that you do like to have that sort of tension, not just of classes, but tension of different, different types of people, you know, and I like that very much. I know that, so many people, before you, is a disturbing subject, what you wrote about.
Yeah.
And both from the point of view that the story's about a quadriplegic and it's the love story, and then, of course, the ending. But you've done a brilliant job of making it really a true love story. Many people are talking about how this is going to be a classic in the whole genre of this type of book. It's wonderful.
Thank you. I just found out today that one of the major retailers in the UK has named it one of their 100 classic reads of all time, so I'm kind of feeling a bit overwhelmed by that at the moment. I think what I like is to take an issue that isn't black and white, and I think just because you're looking at an issue like, you know, quadriplegia or assisted suicide doesn't mean that it has to be dressed up in some kind of highfalutin moral language. I think that often if you just tell a simple story using straightforward language, you can actually cover some really complex issues. And the thing about that was it didn't come up with a conclusion. It didn't say, this is the right way, this is the wrong way, this is how you should do it. It just asked you to put yourself in other people's shoes.
Yes, exactly. It let the reader make the decision within themselves, and I think that was really a very, you know, nice way to do it. If I just, you know, that you don't make that decision for the reader that this is good, this is bad.
Thank you. That's really what I intended.
Well, I think, of course, it's very exciting for you after being on the best-selling list and then, of course, getting a movie deal. And
yes,
deal. I mean, you got Emilia Clarke, right, is from Game of Thrones.
Yep.
And uh-huh. Sam Claflin, who's playing Will?
Will, Sam Claflin. Yeah. You'll know him from Hunger Games.
That's right.
And from a couple of other films like Love, Rosie. He's just wonderful.
So it must have been exciting to, you watched the filming? Because you did.
I did.
You wrote the screenplay, right?
That's right. And it was a real steep learning curve, and I loved every minute. And I think, you know, as a writer, there's a kind of huge privilege in getting to see your people become real. It was the first day was sort of mind blowing.
Well, that's what it's wonderful to see your words on paper, but as a screenwriter myself, it's hearing somebody's speak your words that really, it's amazing. It's an amazing feeling. So,
and I think, you know, well, you'll know being a screenwriter, but being on set, you learn that some words work really well and some lines work really well, and others you have to rewrite because they don't play as well off the page as they did once they're in the hands of the actors. And that was kind of part of the really interesting thing as well, learning that, you know, screenwriting, the screenplay does not exist by itself. It comes to life really with the actors and the action going on behind and the speed and the music and the color. And yeah, that was fascinating.
Well, I know the movie's going to come out next year, right?
That's right. I think sort of May, June. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, that's going to be exciting for you to be at the premiere of a movie based on your bestseller. And I am sure that the new book, you know, after you is going to be, well, you have already, I think, built in audience of 5 million people. So
I hope you're right.
Well, no, I'm sure, because anyone who has read, you know, Me Before You, I think that they are left with that thing, what happens to Lou? And I think your story has been, you know, you did a great job in bringing it forward, and I think it's going to be another bestseller. So I just want to thank you so much for joining me today, because I know it's a very, very busy day for you. You are on a sort of grand tour of America, are you?
That's right. This is day two of a two-week tour of the States.
This is exciting.
Yeah.
And
it is.
So at least you have Skype, so you can see your kids back home.
Yes, they. I like to show them whichever hotel I'm in. We do that thing FaceTime, which has kind of totally changed the lives of all working parents.
Okay.
I think.
Well, that's great. Well, I'm so happy that I got to speak to you even for a little while on this very, very important day for you. And I wish you all the best of luck with this. And I know that my listeners will really enjoy reading the book. And I highly advise it to everybody. And the nice thing, it's available, you know. In the old days, it would always be difficult to get the book that came before. But the wonderful thing nowadays is that everyone can, although this book stands alone, it is nice if people can read, you know, the book that comes before it. So I think it's going to be a really great bestseller. And so everybody out there, if you haven't read Me Before You, go and get that. And then follow it up with Jojo Moyes' brilliant new book, After You.
Thank you so much, Joy. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Jojo. Have a great trip.
Thank you.
Bye now.
And you. Bye.
Hi. This is coming up after the break. We're going to be talking to Michelle Gable about her wonderful book, The Paris Apartment.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. My name is Patsy Gill. My guest today is Michelle Gable, author of A Paris Apartment, based on an incredible story about an apartment in Paris that was locked up for 70 years. Michelle.
Hello.
Thanks for joining me today to talk about this fascinating story of a Paris apartment, a story about a woman from the Belle Epoque era, It's really quite an amazing story. I remember when I first read about it a few years ago in the Daily Mail, and I saw the photos of this apartment in Paris that had been locked up for 70 years. And I was intrigued with the story, and it gave me shivers to know that I had walked down that street many times and never imagined that there was this amazing apartment. So tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this project.
Yep, so as you said, I read the article. My agent actually had forwarded it to me and said, you know, this is an amazing story. A woman had died in the south of France. She was in her 90s, and when they went through her paperwork, they found out that she'd had this apartment in Paris that she'd locked 70 years before, shut it away, and never returned. And it was just filled with these unimaginable treasures, floor to ceiling, just artwork and interesting pieces, and it was an amazing place. And it turned out her grandmother was this famous courtesan from the Belle Epoque era. And, you know, she collected these from her lovers over the years. And it's just such a cool story, you know, not only, okay, well, how did she get all the pieces? Why did the woman lock it for 70 years? And then on top of that, what must it have been like to see it for the first time? So my agent forwarded this and said, you know, I think this could make a very interesting story. And, you know, I took it from there. And that's why there's the two intertwining periods, because I wanted to explore the Belle Epoque as well as the modern day era and what it must have been like to see that for the first time.
Well, I remember when I saw the photos the first time, and there's all this beautiful Belle Epoque furniture, and yet there's modern things from the 30s before the apartment was locked up, like a Mickey Mouse. You know, it was so adorable to see that original, very, very rare Mickey Mouse sitting there, all dusty.
Glorious paintings, and then this whimsy with the Mickey Mouse. So it is really
exactly. So the story of how this apartment was locked up is in itself so amazing. And how, you know, did you actually get to see this apartment once you started?
I've seen the outside of it, but, you know, by the time that this hit the news, because the Boldini portrait of the courtesan, it had been sold at auction, and as well as all the other pieces, and it sold for over 2 million euro at auction. This is the highest ever for that particular artist. So it was kind of after the fact, hey, there was this apartment and the pieces were sold, but isn't this a cool story? So I didn't go inside, no.
Well, so what you did here is you've written a story that is a combination of modern and going back in the past. You've taken two women, and you're telling the story first of the modern woman who goes as a furniture dealer, furniture appraiser, and gets to walk into this apartment, which you know is just it is a thrilling thought. And then, of course, you tell the story of the courtisan, the what is the French word for it, the demi-mondaine, the demi-mondaine,
yep.
and how much of now we know. We know actually some historical facts about this woman, Marthe de Florian, right? She took on that name, Marthe de Florian. She had many famous lovers. So tell us a little bit about her.
Not much is known about her, which is great because it made it perfect for fiction. I didn't have to, you know, I wanted to hold true to the story and the background of what she would have been interested in, but it wasn't, you know, somebody that had a lot of detail behind her. So she did have many affairs with very prominent people. There's one scene in my book where the guys from the Sotheby's auction house, they turn over some pieces of furniture and all these calling cards from all these famous men fall out, and that truly happened. So not only did she have the affair with Boldini, the painter, and that's how the painting was authenticated, is his wife in the... he got married after they'd had this affair, but his wife had written something many, many years ago, obviously, you know, almost 100 years ago, that he'd had an affair with this woman and had painted her, and there was this portrait somewhere of the woman. So it was very, very interesting in that respect. So she just, I mean, we think of a courtesan as not being that prestigious of a job title, but back then, especially these high level that she was, you know, they were the highest members of society. They had the best gowns, the best apartments, the best style, the newest style. They were very much looked up to, because they had to be beautiful, yes, and they had to also be very intelligent and able to hold conversations at the dinner table and at salons and things like that. So she, it's a very interesting world that she lived in. And
well, for anyone who has seen the movie Gigi, they know what sort of the education of a courtesan was entailed, and and the role that they did play, that they were very, very big in society. We don't have the same class of courtesans, I guess, nowadays.
No, I know.
You know, now we have frumpy girls in blue dresses.
Right.
Unlike Martha de Florian, who, of course, the portrait that was painted by Boldoni is amazing, and
it truly is.
To think that it was there 70 years and nobody had seen it and nobody knew about it, and then wow, tell us a little bit about Boldoni himself, because I was very happy that one of the things that came out of this discovery was that people recognized Boldoni for his talent, I had seen his work before, and I love portraits, and I thought he really makes them come alive.
Yeah, they call him the master of swish, and you can see why, because there's so much movement in his portraits. If you go and look at all of the portraits he's done of very, very famous people of the time, the portraits do come alive. He has this magical way about him. And just as in the book, he did at a certain point go out of fashion, but when you look at everything and everyone he'd painted, and actually one of the portraits he'd done, I went and studied every single portrait he'd done and the people behind them, because they were all very interesting, noteworthy folks. One of the other portraits he'd done actually inspired my second book. It's not, a sequel, or it's not the same structure of someone coming into an abandoned house. But, so another painting of his, of Gladys Deacon, the Duchess of Marlborough, also inspired in me another story. So it's his work is just beautiful.
Well, it is, and I like the, when you look at it, it's sort of like you just opened your eyes, and it's that that amazing appeal that he has. So I was very happy that he got the recognition, because he'd been more or less forgotten for a long time, and I think he well deserves this kind of recognition.
Now, yeah, a lot of people have said to me, "Oh, I didn't even know he was a real person." So
it's exactly. Well, and of course his portrait of Marte is beautiful. And when you were have you actually seen the real portrait? Did you manage to see the real portrait?
I have not seen the real portrait.
I don't know who bought it.
Yeah, I think it was bought privately. I don't know that the records were there. But what's very interesting is in the French edition of the book, which comes out next month, they were actually able to track down the guy that did see the apartment for the first time. And he wrote a little foreword about everything and included some of his own pictures and things like that. So it's pretty fascinating to have gotten his take as well.
Now, as I said, the story goes between modern times and the past. When you were working on the character for the modern character, the art or furniture appraiser, how did you base her? What did you base her on?
I don't know anyone who has her specific job, though I do have a friend that used to work at Sotheby's, so she helped me with a few things, just, sanity checking some things. So I read a lot of memoirs about people that work in the auction house. I talked to people, I interviewed people, read articles, things like that, to try to get a sense of what her life might have been like, or might be like, if that's her occupation. It's so foreign to me that it's hard to imagine that being your daily life, that being a high-end furniture expert. She's gone to school. She's very well educated. She's gone to school for this. This is her expertise, and it's so fascinating to me. I love, that's the great thing to me about writing, is the research, not just the historical piece of it, but also the modern-day pieces, or, worlds that I don't know anything about. So she was just based on, she came to me as, I knew I wanted to explore what it must have been like to see it for the first time, so she came to me sort of in that sense.
And so as a character, she is married, and this mm-hmm. opportunity to fly to Paris to see this apartment is really quite an amazing event for her.
She's very excited to get out of town. She's having some personal issues. And so, and she lived in Paris for a time, and she just loves it there. And so for her, it's just the perfect opportunity. It's work. It's this, and for her business, it's this apartment full of pieces that have never been to market. So for her, that's a very big deal. The pieces that have never been to market. It's all brand new to, you know, the auction world, of course. She thinks it's about the furniture, but when she gets there, you know, she's much more involved in Marc de Florin's past and the journals that she uncovers in the apartment.
Well, when you're writing about Marc, you're using sort of a diary form, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And now, were there real diaries in the apartment?
Not that I know of. There could have been. One of the photographs from the apartment, there's this little bookshelf in the lower left-hand corner, and it looks like it's crammed with papers and journals. And so when I saw that picture, to me, I thought, oh, my gosh, those look like journals. So that's why Marc's story is told entirely through her journal entries. And funny enough, those came so easily to me. I almost felt like I was channeling her. It was kind of funny. I don't know what that says about me, but it flowed very easily. And I did find some journals of a different courtesan, and it was interesting because she was a courtesan turned princess turned nun. So she ran the full gamut, and it was just interesting to read the kinds of things she cared about or the types of parties she attended or, you know, all those little things about her daily life that would have likely been similar for Marc.
So when what you managed to do here very nicely is really bring Paris alive. You spent a lot of time in Paris before you wrote this book?
Yeah, I go quite a bit for work myself for my day job, and so you know, not to the extent that the main character in the book, you know, she's lived there, she has a very rich understanding, she's, you know, spent months and months, if not years there. You know, not to that extent, but I have been quite a number of times, and I love it there. I mean, what's not to love, right? It's there's so much about the city that's so stirring almost. I definitely have spent time there. And I was actually in Paris when my agent called to say that the publishing house wanted to acquire the book.
Now, your character, Luke, mm-hmm. is interesting. He has many of the qualities of French people that I don't know if you've ever read a book by Olivier Magny. He wrote Stuff Parisians Like.
No, I haven't.
Well, you have to read it because he writes about many of the French ideas about Americans that you've used there. So like how Americans talk or how they act. So Luke has some preconceived notions of Americans.
What... He certainly does. Yeah.
Did you enjoy writing the Luke character? Tell us a little bit about him. What's his involvement with? April is the
yes.
name of the. Our. I don't know if I had mentioned that. When you read the book, you
yeah.
think automatically. So her name is April Voigt.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And
yep.
When she gets to Paris and she meets a Frenchman, what yep. happens?
So he's kind of there right from the start because he's in charge of the estate that, he's the attorney in charge of it. So he's an attorney and he's sort of overseeing and determining what stays and goes. And ultimately, you know, at first she kind of views him as a roadblock. Why is this attorney hanging around? But then, of course, he's handsome in his, you know, very French way. It's very different from the men that, you know, and her husband, her estranged husband that she's used to. You know, he's all tall, blonde, handsome, athletic, and Lucas is looks like a Frenchman, you know, trim, dark hair, he smokes, you know, but she... At first, he's viewed as kind of an annoyance to her, but then he actually helps her get her hands on something she wouldn't have otherwise, and then he also just kind of she's just a little insecure when she goes there, or a lot insecure, and feeling, oh my gosh, I don't know what's next in my life. Her whole world's been turned upside down, but she's there to do work, and she's trying to be serious, and she kind of defaults to that, to work and to her seriousness when she's when all else is, you know, crumbling around her. And so he kind of helps her loosen up and not only enjoy the city itself, Paris, but also the things that she finds and the lives that were coming in and out of that particular home. So she, I think he opens her eyes quite a bit to kind of looking deeper at what's around her.
Okay, I'm not going to ask who you base that on.
No, I mean, he has some characteristics of people I've known, you know, some of his little things that he does and things like that, but certainly I've never met a French attorney when I've been traveling.
Okay, that's a good idea. Interest. That's a good idea, because I understand you're married and you have...
I do.
How many children?
I have two daughters.
Oh, that's nice. Now, you know, it's so funny when you mentioned your day job, and you do have a day job, which is quite different from writing.
Yes. Yeah, my background is in finance, and I'm the VP of investor relations for a software company. So I do, you know, I talk to investors, and I do financial models and that kind of thing. So it is very different, although... You know, stories need structure. What I like about finance is the structure and the balance, and stories need structure and balance, too. So I do think in some ways they're complementary, and I really do like going back and forth between the two.
Now I want to talk to you. You know, this is a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and we all dream of writing, and to have an agent who actually asks you to write a book is a fantastic thing. Tell me about your agent.
So I've been with my agent, Barbara Powell, since 2008, early 2008, so quite a long time. It's been 7 years. We had other books that she tried to shop that didn't sell, and actually it was in 2010, and she'd sent out a book. It was in September. She sent out a book that I'd written, and immediately five publishers wanted to acquire the book, and it was very exciting, and we were going to do an auction, and then one by one, all the publishing houses dropped out, and the problem was the editors loved the book so much, they wanted to bid against each other for it, but at the end of the day, they just said, you know what, it's just too hard to sell a debut author, she doesn't have a name, she doesn't have, you know, any cachet, and, you know, this is 2010, so the economy is not great, and it's especially bad in the publishing world, so, you know, it was very discouraging, obviously, because I'd always just told myself, well, I'll write another book and another book and another book, and if I write 50 books before I get published, that's completely fine. You know, I'll be 85 years old, and that's fine. But how was I ever going to get over this debut author hump, you know, if I couldn't get a book published? So I just really didn't know where to go from there. I always had more ideas and just kept moving on, and as she would submit things, I would just write the next story. But now I felt kind of stuck, and it was a couple weeks after that she had emailed me this article about the Parisian apartment, and then so that ended up being where I went from there. So it was cool. I mean, I feel so lucky that, you know,
lucky. You are like one of the luckiest writers in the world, because first of all, of course, Barbara Powell is well known in the industry. She's a great agent, and of course, she belongs to the Irene Goodman Literary Agency, which is the premier literary agency, and that Barbara Powell would stick with you and believe in you and feed you this story is fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I mean, because by that point, you know, we didn't sell the book until, you know, it sold in 2013 and came out in 2014. So at that point, you know, I'd already been with her for 5 years, and agents don't make money unless you make money. So she really just believed in me. And, you know, of course, I'm grateful she sent it to me, that article to me, and not another client. Of course, you know, she probably wanted me to start making money or something. But it was, you know, she just stuck with me, and I kept saying to her, you know, really, honestly, I know you're not doing this just for fun. You're trying to make a living. So if you need to move on, I totally get it. And she's like, nope, I believe in you. I this is going to happen. So.
Well, she is amazing, and you are truly, truly lucky to be represented, you know, represented by really the best agency in New York. And Irene Goodman has great taste, and obviously Barbara Powell is a great agent. So I'm
she's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now tell us a little bit about you. You say that, of course, this was your first published novel, but you've been writing since you were a kid.
Yep, since I was 10 years old, my parents gave me a book called Someday You'll Write when I was 10, and I've just always written since then. My friends, I still have many of my childhood friends are still good friends of mine today, and they joke how I'd make them do writing groups for play dates and things like that. And, I'd always just done it as a hobby, and finally, you know, in my 30s, I decided to try to do something with it, and then the book came out a few weeks before I turned 40, and my parents still had the book that they'd given me when I turned 10, and they regave it to me the night of my launch 30 years later, so I did work at it, you know, 30 years behind the scenes.
Well, that's fantastic. I recently did an interview with the new poet laureate for the United States, Felipe Herrera, and he was telling me how his third grade teacher was the greatest influence on, besides of course his mother and father, on him, you know, believing in himself and him wanting to, you know, move ahead in his writing. So I was wondering, did you have a particular teacher that encouraged you, or was it just your family?
Just a lot of teachers over my family, but a lot of teachers over the years. I mean, I remember I would take, even though I majored in accounting in college, I would take creative writing classes, and I mean, even though professors there encouraged me quite a bit. Teachers just in high school and in junior high throughout, and you know, one of my English teachers came to a signing just randomly, and I hadn't seen her since high school, and she had read about it in the paper and came, so it was so cool. So it just kind of a lot of people have been very encouraging over the years. I mean, of course, my parents, but outside people. But I also kept it a secret from a lot of people. A lot of people were very surprised when I said that I had a book coming out. They felt like it came out of nowhere. Wait, you're the finance person. Since when do you write? Oh, did you just, like, write a book and it came out? You know, they kind of viewed it as, I must just... You know, they didn't know the background. Only people that knew me very well knew how long I've been working
and
at it.
And speaking of when did you write? what is your schedule when you have a full-time job? When did you find time to write?
Whenever I can get it in. I do wake up very early, so that helps. And I just know how much I need to get done in terms of writing in a day, as well as work and kids and everything else. So I'm pretty good about knowing how long things take me and managing my time. And I call it hyper-focusing on something. It's not multitasking, because multitasking, you can't really give your full attention to any one thing. But if I'm doing something, I'm doing that one thing, and I'm really deep in it, and then, you know, I can pull out pretty quickly and switch tasks. So I think it's just that constant... just a constant in my mind figuring out, okay, I need to do these things today, and this is where it gets slotted in, and okay, well, I'm going to have 30 minutes here and 10 minutes over there, and okay, well, I can get my 1,000 words today or whatever. So it's usually kind of broken down like that. And you know, my girls, they play competitive softball, and last summer I had to write my second book. I had to write that whole thing. I wrote that whole thing in pencil by hand, because we were at, you know, tournaments in faraway places, and I didn't want to bring my computer to dirty, dusty fields, so I wrote it all by hand. As, you know, the girls were warming up pitching, I'd be behind the, you know, the backstop writing, or in the car before the game started. So it's really when I can get it in. I'm pretty good about just eking out the time here and there in, you know, little increments.
Now, when you do write on the computer, what program do you use? What computer program?
I use Scrivener to kind of organize, and while I'm writing.
It's a great program. It's a great...
It's really good. I feel like I'm not using it to its full capability. I bought a book about it, just so I'm sure there it can do so much more, but it is great. And then once I've kind of gone through it a couple times, then I put it into Word and just go from there. But at that point, it's pretty, you know, I'm just editing it.
So how many months did it take you to do the research for this book?
I'll spend a couple months researching, but I also will research kind of while I'm writing. I'll also go, I'll try to do a ton of research, too, like towards the last quarter of writing a book. So my third book, I'm near the end right now, and I'm doing also a ton of research in addition to the writing, because I find sometimes it's easier, I do the research to get a framework for everything, but sometimes it's easier to do a lot of research way later when the book is almost done, because you know where it's going to get slotted in. Sometimes when you're researching before, you find these cool facts and you're not sure how they fit in, and it can be almost overwhelming, all the stuff you find. But if you're doing it when the book's mostly done, you can kind of read, oh, that's interesting, but I don't quite need to know it for this book. And then, you know, generally I'll ship off the first draft, not a first draft. I mean, I've been gone through it many times, but first clean draft to my agent, and as she's reviewing it, I'll do more research. So there's points along the way where I can still make changes to the manuscript when other people are looking at it. And so I'll go back and just do research on, so I keep a running list. Okay, find out more about this particular topic. I'll have some sort of base level knowledge, but then I do a deeper dive, later. So it is a really, I do a lot at the front end, but I also, it's an ongoing process for me.
Well, I found one of the, of course, in your book, explain a little bit Mart's relationship with Victor Hugo's daughter.
So, and that's a fictional relationship.
Yes.
So, she just has a very, she has some degree of ire towards the woman, and she feels jealous. You know, this woman is very celebrated, and she has this great family and this storied life, although, peel back the layers, and that's not really quite the case. And Mark just looks at it like, why does she get all that? What does she have that I don't have? There's more reasons too behind her, which I don't want to give any spoilers for your listeners, but there are some more reasons behind the way she feels why she does. But she kind of feels like she's almost has this celebrity for no reason, and it's not. And Mark's had to work very hard for everything she's been given, so she feels like it's unfair. So she definitely
had you already known a great deal about Victor Hugo when you introduce this character?
Not a lot, a little bit. I wouldn't say a great deal, no. But, the daughter is really his daughter, but...
So the idea just came to you, like, whoo?
Yeah.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, that happens sometimes.
It does sure. happen. It's yeah. like, it's those wonderful moments when we get... sometimes we don't know as a writer where the ideas come from. It could be way back in our minds that we read something years and years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Something just pops up from nowhere, and it's such a happy accident.
It is. And well, I enjoyed your Marcel Proust connections, because I read Marcel Proust, I think, when I was 14 years old, and there's never... I don't know any other writer who's used him in a book. So where did that come from?
Again, it was and he's actually plays a pretty not a large role in my second book, but he's very prominent in the second one as well. Just as I was researching the historical piece, he was Mart makes a comment about him being a gossip monger, and he was a gossip columnist. I mean, we think of him as being very erudite and, heavy, but he started that way, and so I thought that was so interesting, and also, reading old documents and old newspaper articles and old gossip columns even, he was very much out and about in these circles, he made a lot of appearances. He was, people knew him. He definitely would have run in these circles. He definitely would have been friends with Mart. So I just thought, he's such an interesting character that he appeared in the book. And then what's funny is when I was researching for my second book, and the character that I decided to base it on, or the woman who was the real life person, she was best friends with Marcel Proust in real life. So he has an even bigger role. And it kind of confirmed that, okay, then of course she would, of course Marta Florian would have been friends with them too, because this woman was, and they both were friends with Boldini, and they both had the same career, so it kind of confirmed, as a lot of the book did, actually, even though it's not a sequel, confirmed a lot of what I, assumptions I made in the first book, where I didn't have information. So he's just an interesting character, and there's a bit about, in my second book, even, not even just about him, but about his writing style and what his book, In Search of Lost Time, meant for the literary world. So there's a little bit of talk of that in the second book.
And when is the second book coming out?
In February.
Well, that's fantastic. And I hope maybe you'll come back on the program in February and tell us more about it.
I would absolutely love to.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. And so I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been so interesting. And I think, as I said, the book is great, and I'm glad that I was able to talk to you about it, and I look forward to the next book. And you're very lucky to have such a wonderful agent. And,
Thank you.
I don't know, how did you originally? I have to ask this because everybody, before I let you go, because a lot of writers listen to this program, and they're always asking, well, how did you get the agent? So how did you ever get Barbara Poile in the first place? I mean, it was a query letter.
Yep, just a blind query, a manuscript and a query, and I didn't know her. I didn't have any personal connection. She fished it out of the slush pile. That's it.
Well, it must have been one heck of a query letter.
Thank you.
Because I know that Irene Goodman's agency gets such an enormous number of submissions because everyone wants to be represented by them. And so, I think probably, I don't know if you have that query letter, but you should frame that and put it right over your computer. And because, as a matter of fact, you probably should write an article about it and for one of the writers' magazines and tell people how you managed to write such a fantastic query letter that got you so far. And so it's wonderful to have spoken to you. And I look forward to speaking to you in February.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.